Carriger, president of Capstone Marketing. I am delighted to be talking today with Michelle Golden, the newest inductee into the Association for Accounting Marketing Hall of Fame. Many of you probably know Michelle from her days at Golden Practices. After 14 years of consulting, she made a bold move and joined Keiko Isom, formerly Kennedy & Co., as an owner and growth leader. There, Michelle works on aligning sales, marketing, and value creation with operations and strategic objectives. She guides and works closely with the firm's pricers, industry strategists, and the marketing communications and sales teams, and participates on the firm's five-person leadership team. I could go on and on. Michelle is a published author, a TEDx presenter, and accounting industry influencer. Check out her profile on LinkedIn for more. Congratulations, Michelle, and welcome to the Capstone Conversation.
Thank you, Jean. It's a pleasure to join you today.
I know we've known each other a long time, Michelle, and this award was so well-deserved and probably a bit late in your receiving it, but absolutely well-deserved to be inducted into the AIM Hall of Fame. How did that feel that night?
Oh, my gosh. I was very surprised. I was actually out of the room at the moment at a different dinner, and I was receiving some odd texts from people demanding my presence urgently. So I ran downstairs and was really touched and honored with the recognition in Ames Hall of Fame. It was pretty cool. I was surprised because I have not been as involved in AIM over the last 5 to 10 years as I had been very, very, very heavily involved in the 90s and early 2000s. And then just, you know, life took me in some different directions that made it a little bit hard. I had to make some choices about where to spend my energy, and I wasn't as involved with AIM. So it was really surprised, but I don't know that it was late for something like that. I don't know that there's a time schedule for it, but thank you so much.
Right. You're welcome. So Michelle, let's start off. You know, we both understand that accounting marketing can be challenging. What do you think is the greatest challenge in marketing CPA firms?
I would have to say that it is finding the true actual distinctive thing about the firm's service to a particular niche or the firm's practice areas. Really, if you go from one website to another or talk to one CPA versus another, you're hearing ultimately the same stories over and over. And a lot of the things that if you ask somebody, well, what makes this firm different, whether it's my firm or any of the firms that I've consulted with over the years, the list of things that people are going to tell you are identical. They're all table stakes. You know, we're experts in our field. Well, so is your neighbor firm on either side of you. Everybody's an expert in that niche, which is why, you know, everybody has gone to niches. That's been a big thing over the last 20 years, and it's been very fruitful. But, you know, some firms are more deep in niches than others. And I think it's our job. And the biggest challenge is to really hold someone out. I would say that, you know, there are some key factors that if they're not met, would say the firm really isn't in a niche. And I would categorize it as dabbling. And my opinion is you can't really differentiate or hold yourself out if you're a dabbler. You have to be deep. And it's hard to get CPAs sometimes to really go deep enough to make a difference.
Right, because don't they feel that if they start focusing in specific areas that they're missing opportunities out of those areas of focus?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. There's I don't even know who's saying it is, but I want to say Steve Jobs, and that's probably not right, so I'd hate to go down that road too deeply, but you are who you don't serve. You know, we don't want to exclude anyone, so we're really afraid to say, hey, we're in banking because we don't want to exclude contractors or vice versa. And you can't be compelling and convincing that you're, you know, 100 miles deep in 50 areas if you have 7 people in your firm. It's just not going to work.
Right, because we've also seen websites where they list their industry expertise and there's 14 industries there.
Yeah, that's a lot. And I mean, I'm in a firm now where we have over, 300 people. And, a firm my size can't really be more than four or five truly deep areas. And if you're I grew up and I loved the firm I grew up in, but I grew up in a firm that at the time had seven partners and about 80 people. And, we had probably 14 practice areas listed and we were probably truly rich in maybe three of those. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that ratio works out, Jean, with what you see in the two, but I'd say a firm under 150 people, you probably have really two mega strong areas and the rest are probably, a good list of representative clients.
Right. So what do you think is the pitch, if you will, to partners to help sell the idea or convince a partner group about the value of really focusing and being true specialists in mm-hmm. a niche?
Yeah, that's good. What I say is that there are three, I tell them that there are three things that are absolutely requisite if they're serious about wanting to differentiate themselves in a niche. And one is that you have to read. You have to, whether it's reading online or reading magazines, the trade publications, or what have you, you have to read, I want to say daily, but that might be a lot. How about weekly? You have to stay in touch. You have to be reading blogs or reading articles or reading, print materials, whatever it is, you have to constantly be reading and learning about your niche. If you're not, then you're not truly a specialist in it. I would cut that. I would say that's predominant. What do they say? Readers are leaders.
Believe that.
Yeah, and how can you be influential if you're not in touch? How can you be out there, really growing and having an impact on an industry? So that would be my second one. I would say reading is number one. Number two is actually impacting, having an impact, whether it's bringing people together, focus groups and peer groups and whatever, to help influence or change what's happening. Maybe it's just locally in your area. Maybe, and it can be through, like, say it's construction. Maybe it's through a construction-related organization where you gather people together and help them create a better environment for their industry. And I'm not talking about financial tax stuff. I'm talking about actually business growth and creating opportunities, or maybe getting involved if you're construction, maybe getting involved with, community development and, whatever it is, the regional chamber, something like that, to create more credits for people to move into your area so that there's more construction opportunity, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is probably a lagging indicator, but I would say that when you are influential and when you are a specialist, you will be sought after to both speak and write and participate in organizations related to that vertical market. So if you're being asked to speak at conferences, that's a great thing. But if you're not combining that with the reading and the leading and impacting, you can do more.
Right. Right, that's awesome. And we know people who are doing that, and we know a lot of people who are not.
Sure, absolutely. And it doesn't mean shame on you. What it really means is to pick, we have a lot of generalists, and that's great. Generalists are awesome. You can still be a generalist, but you do need to pick one thing that you just kind of, like, picture cars on a freeway. And, maybe there are 10 cars. You can do work with all 10, but really accelerate, put the pedal to the metal on one, which is the one thing that you want to grow. Right. I think accountants get bored, and they don't want to be locked into, say, banking or whatever. So what I say is grow that one thing, get the momentum, and bring people under you to take that over when you get bored with it, and then go jump over and do your construction or do your nonprofit or whatever. but don't feel like just because you're picking that for now that it's the permanent rest of your life choice. This is not a spouse.
Interesting. Okay.
But yeah, to grow an area, you have to have enough, you have to have energy. And you, when you start dividing your energy among too many practice areas, you can't do any of them well. So pick one thing to really throw your energy up for a few years. Make sure you cultivate people underneath you to step into those relationships or join you in those relationships from the start, right? That's ideal. Mm-hmm. And then you can kind of feel comfortable handing it off as you move into the other stuff that you're excited about next.
Absolutely. What are the biggest changes you've noticed in accounting marketing over the past 5 years?
Technology, for sure. Mm-hmm. Adapting and embracing newer media over old forms of media. The print ad, for instance, being much less useful than, say, content. I would add to that, I would say more people are willing to cease being generalists and are seeking to specialize. So I would say that has been a big change. When I started in accounting marketing, like you, Jean, you were ahead of me. I started about 20 years ago. Everyone wanted to be a generalist. The way we found our niches was to run a list of our clients, categorize them by back then SIC codes, and kind of see where we had our bulk. Now it's really where people have their passion, and they're kind of naturally gravitating that way. Plus, with standards are, you know, getting stricter and more knowledge is needed to focus in a particular area, it is harder to dabble, and I think CPAs are embracing that. So that's really good. The other thing that has changed a lot, reflecting on 20 years, is back then, people were not available to market between January and April. And now I think CPAs understand that they can't stop. And in fact, that's the best time to be out there and actively growing their businesses.
Right.
Those are just some of the things I can think of.
Right. It's interesting to hear you say that about January through April. Because we both know they can't completely stop and expect then, you know, on May 1, for example, to start all over again for however many months they're willing to put into it and actually see any results. So it's probably not the same effort as it is in the balance of the year, but it's something. Is that what you're finding?
Yeah, I do. I think that is the case. I think that they're realizing, you know, they know, because think about when all those opportunities arise for proposals between December and March. There are a lot of proposals, and they've always kind of squeezed those in, but haven't really been as involved as I think that folks are now. Mm-hmm. The other really, really massive change, and I think it's a fabulous change, is getting younger folks involved in what are considered business development or growth activities much earlier in their career. It used to be that, you know, partners wouldn't even involve a staff person, even a manager, really, back in the, you know, in the 90s, even a manager level person wasn't that involved in marketing. But then suddenly when they're getting ready to be made partner, it's, hey, you need a book of business. Mm-hmm. And so now I think that they're recognizing we start teaching our seniors and our younger associates probably about third year. We really start getting them involved in what it takes to nurture a business relationship, and both starting with existing customers, but also recognizing external opportunities. There's not an expectation of business development among their peers yet, though, because their peers aren't business decision makers, and it's not a natural fit. We don't want people bringing in 1040 work.
Right.
So, you know, those aren't good clients. We don't want them actively bringing in clients that we don't want to keep. So that would be very discouraging to them. But we do want them going on sales calls so that we can role model and have them emulate, you know, different types of sales behavior. The other danger, right, you've seen this, is when only one person in the firm is considered a rainmaker and marketing looks like Bill. And if you're not like Bill, you're never going to be successful marketing. Well, what we want them to see, that marketing can look like Michelle, marketing can look like Jean, marketing can look like Susie and Joe and Bill and Bob. There's lots of different styles. So if they get to rotate on to some sales opportunities with those different people, they can actually see what styles are comfortable for them.
Exactly. So that they know that they can have their own style. Because when you've got that one person, that can be so intimidating because the thought is, I will never be like that person. So
yeah.
I guess there's just no opportunity for me when that is not true.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I agree. The quicker that firms can get their people involved, you know, let them get the, you know, the CPA exam out of the way. Let them get certified. Let them really learn how public accounting works, and then you know, incorporate them into marketing and business development. That's awesome. So, what's your prediction for accounting marketing for the next 5 years?
That's the hardest question. My crystal ball has this big, giant crack, so it's really hard to say for sure. Accounting marketing. So I think consolidation, I'm going to throw probably three things out there. Consolidation is an issue. My personal favorite is pricing. If we all price exactly the same and we're all running into the walls of, you know, there are only this many hours in a year and these are our rates and our rates times hours, we have a maximum revenue opportunity. And we're starting to learn finally, it's taking, you know, 15 years or so of constantly being beaten up by the rebels and the revolutionaries that are consulting to the CPA firms, but we're starting to realize that hours don't equate to value. And we're starting to realize that, you know, sometimes if I can resolve something for you in 1 hour, it's far more valuable to you than if it takes me 3 months of 8 hour days. So we shouldn't necessarily equate our time to our price. And it's a very, very hard thing, hard habit to break, especially when all of our firm's metrics are around production hours. And I think I see much more interest among top 100 firms in exploring ways to price that as our people become more expensive, you know, when it became a requisite to have a master's degree for an accounting, for a CPA certificate, it then made people even more expensive. And then the talent crunch of 10 years ago made people more expensive. And now the current talent crunch is making people more expensive. When you charge about the same, but your people cost more, I know I'm not a CPA, but I think that the math starts to make margins pretty small.
Right.
So we really do need to look at other ways to price our work. Now, with that said, if you price things based on what they're actually worth to the customer, sometimes you have to make hard choices that, hey, if it's only worth this to the customer, and that's all they would be willing to pay for it, maybe I don't really want to do that work. And maybe that's not the best use of my time to do that kind of work because it's not valued highly in the marketplace. Or is there something I can do to put more value with that work to make it more highly valued in the marketplace and therefore more worth it to me? So we talk about, you know, worth being, has to be good for everybody. It has to be worth it to the client to pay the price that they're going to pay, and it has to be worth it to you to do the work at that price. And if it's not, I'd sure want to know before I send somebody a bill if they don't think that the amount that I need to charge them is worth it. We've been really lazy in our profession about having conversations about what something's actually going to cost because we have this crutch that it's like it's justifying, well, it took me 10 hours to do it, so that's my price. Mm-hmm. And that's, I don't think it's the right way to do business, and I don't think it's the most responsible way. If we don't know how much something is going to cost and we're charging for it, who does know?
Right.
You know, should our clients all walk up to us with a blank, you know, with a blank check and expect a, you know, expect to have, should we expect them to trust us if we can't even give them a definitive price for the work that we're going to help them with?
Right. And you bring up an interesting point because there's I've seen more and even one of the keynote speakers at Practitioners in Orlando talked about how we're spending our time and what we're doing with our time and how our work, there should be a component of our work in things that we are passionate about, and the idea of giving back. And really, you know, I think a lot of people, I'll admit, you know, people my age, I mean, we're really giving a lot of thought to that. Of, you know, there is so much time. What do we want to be doing with it? So what are the best, most valuable things or enjoyable things that we can spend our time on, and how does that correlate to your client base and how you are living your work life?
Yes. Yep. It's choices, right? We're all, and the CPAs are doing that too. It's really no different than when we're asking CPAs to focus on a specialty. We're asking them to invest their energy and time in growing their knowledge about a particular one of 5 or 10 areas they might work in. We're asking them to commit to growth there.
Right.
And it is very much very similar. Giving back, and that's the other thing too, for us to really add value. And I think that's the answer to where we're going in the next few years, is really, is what we're doing worthwhile? I had an awesome conversation with Jason Blummer. I don't know if you know Jason from Thrival.
I know of him. We haven't had the opportunity to meet him.
He's a crazy rebel accountant who left a big firm, started his own gig. And what he said was he got really disenchanted. He was about 5 or 6 years into practice, and he got really disenchanted because clients would ask him, you know, as becoming a, you know, strong senior, they would go, I don't even understand why I need these financial statements. I don't do anything with them. And he started really looking, and he's like, you don't. They're not helpful to your future. They're just a snapshot of the past. They're not helping you, you know, and sometimes we try and kind of BS our way out of it. Well, you know, your audit report is going to help you make decisions going forward. No, it's a management letter with some points
on it. And your banker needs it. Yeah.
Yeah, and your banker needs it and everything. But, you know, your management letter's got points on it that are still going to be there next year. It's not like really, it's not groundbreaking. It's not changing that organization. It's not creating a transformational experience for the company. We actually, as business advisors, have to do things in addition to the compliance work to be transformational for the client. Otherwise, it truly is a commodity. And anybody that, you know, it's, I say this all the time, accountants, CPAs are the only ones who can do an audit. Yet we go out and we underbid each other over and over and over. We were just up against a bigger firm in the top 100, much bigger, who came in at 20% of what we quoted to get the work. And we're just sitting there, like, there is no way they're going to lose so bad on that work. I mean, we actually built in a profit margin. They obviously went in expecting a substantial loss.
Right.
And we're not willing to do that. We're not willing to fight for that work in that new market that hard. Like, no, if the client isn't going to respect our value from the start, that's not the kind of client that we have, that we want to have. But what you're seeing with audit and tax work, you're going to see that increase more and more. And if you think about it with the audit, who values the audit, really? It's going to be the shareholders. You know, in a public company, it's the shareholders. It's the people choosing whether or not that company is worth investing in, if their books can be validated. And it's really the market, the stock market. So why the corporation is the one buying the audit, it really should be Wall Street buying the audits. We're not neutral at all. We want that client back next year. It should be the stock market's buying the audits, et cetera, et cetera. Accountants should be doing much better, deeper, richer stuff with the products that we're providing. We should be out there helping people transform their businesses to be stronger in the future. I think shareholders, whether a public company or just a, you know, a private group of stakeholders, would be much more excited about spending the same amount of money on something that's going to help them truly transform their business rather than just meet a banker's or bonding agent's requirement.
Right. Truly being that business advisor to help business owners look forward in their business instead of recording what has already happened.
Right. Unless we learn from what's happened, but really, what are the learnings? Could we maybe summarize, you know, could we maybe summarize those learnings in a new, better way? I mean, other than telling them, well, you have risk here and you need some different internal controls, I don't know what significant value we're adding in the audit area without adding extra products to it. Benchmarking is dandy, but like for me, I'm, you know, now a partner in a CPA firm, and people tell me all the time, oh, you need to look at this accounting benchmarking report, and that's all well and good, but we're not like other accounting firms in so many ways. That's this kind of a navel gazing that I'm not really very interested in doing. I want to outperform other CPA firms. I do look at areas where we lag behind others. But on the flip side, our business model is really different. Our personnel ratios are quite different. And how we price is quite different. Oddly, though, our margins are pretty comparable to most firms, even though we don't price the traditional way for the majority of our clients. But I'd like to break that number way out.
Right, right. Well, you've only been there a short time, so I know you'll be blazing another trail there, Michelle.
Patience is not my virtue, Jean.
So we know lots of marketers, right?
Mm-hmm.
What skills or factors enable accounting marketers to be successful?
I think it's the same ones that enable our CPAs to be successful. I think it's passion. I think it's diplomacy. I think it's care. And I think it's winning people over one at a time. I've watched a lot of marketers over the last 20, 25 years who are so adept, so skilled, and brilliant, and come in, and they're passionate to begin with. And I've watched them, you know, boldly charge into the boardroom and make lots of great recommendations I would be 100% behind because they're right and they're for all the right reasons. But either, you know, feeling like they're running into a brick wall, fighting a losing battle, not getting funding. I can just list probably the 10 things that I would say lead to the marketer's feeling of failure, whether it's the firm feeling like the marketer wasn't a fit or the marketer feeling like the firm wasn't a fit. And, you know, I would say that it's patience and understanding that you need to win over, it's not just the partners, it's partners, managers, and staff, literally one person at a time. You will not have everyone supporting you. It's just not going to happen. But if you can make one person successful in a way that they weren't successful before you interacted with them, that word will spread. They will become your advocate. And pretty soon, you know, somebody will come in and say, hey, Jean, I saw what you did for Dawn. Can you do that for me? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it will just grow organically. So I would say patience, understanding, learning the field, just like we tell our CPAs to learn the industry, learn the accounting field. Learn what the terminology means. Learn how clients think about CPAs and help teach CPAs how clients think about them. Mm-hmm. One other thing I would throw in there, because I don't like easy answers. I would say one other thing is help those CPAs be less myopic. Accounting firms think about everything in terms of themselves. Instead of from the client's perspective, if you can constantly take the voice of the client and say, well, what, you know, what's in it for the client if we say this? Isn't that all about us, not all about the client?
Right.
Oh, wow. And it's a default position. It's a very self-centered default position. Very natural for a business to think that way. But we have to be thinking about everything we do and say as we go to market, we have to be thinking about the client's perspective. Just sitting out, this is a true story. I had a law firm that I worked with for a long, long time. And one of their lawyers came back from a conference and said, I think we need to put up on our website how technologically advanced we are that we use 3 monitors. And I can feel your eyes rolling, Jean. I'm like, no. First of all, if you've ever watched Simon Sinek, have you seen his TED Talk?
Yes, I have. And I actually saw him speak at the HubSpot conference last year.
Oh, yeah. He's so amazing. So he has this Start With Why book. And what he talks about is because people don't care about what you do, which we list. All of our websites have, we do this service, and we do audits, we do tax returns, we do estate plans, we do this, we do that. People don't care what you do, and they don't care how you do it. We use 3 monitors. We use 8. You know, I use this software. I use that software. I have an MBA. I don't. You know, we don't care how you do it. What we care about is why you do it. And I was just talking to one of our young partners this morning about, she's going to sit down with a client that we've had for about a year and talk to them about how to basically price the next year because we're losing a lot of money, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, I don't want you to list all the pieces of paper that you hand them. I don't want you to give them this task list of this product and this product and this product. I said, come in with a line item that says, this was a construction company, satisfy your bonding agent's requirements so you get your bond back. Mm-hmm. That's why.
Right. Right.
That's all you need. They don't need to know what 8 documents it's going to take to do that. They need to know what the outcome is for them. We need to satisfy the bonding agent to get your bond back. That's what we need. That's what we need to put out there. That's the client's perspective. It's not my to-do list.
Right. That's a whole mind shift. You're right. It's not. And that book, I mean, it's on my shelf here, you know, having read it. And I think Tom Hood recommended that to me as well. In focusing why you do something and not what or how.
Yep. I can't emphasize it enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, goodness. Awesome. So, Michelle, let me ask you, which of your personal skills contributes most to your success? Because you've done a lot. You've done many interesting things. You're a published author. You're a TEDx presenter. You've been on the consulting side, and now you're back on the firm side in a very high level role within your firm. Which one of your skills contributed most to making that happen?
Oh boy, it's kind of funny because I think the skill that has kept me alive is also the skill that's gotten me fired. I would probably have to say, you know, revolutionary thinking. I'm not satisfied with status quo. That's just me, though. I know lots of people who aren't pushy that way and aren't always telling people they have to try different things or break out of that box. I would say it's not being satisfied with status quo, but the way I translate that into something that is less scary, because my audience or my beloved CPAs can be really frightened by my craziness sometimes that way. So I would say, and this is my why, because after watching Simon Sinek, I sat down and I crafted my why. The thing that, quote, turns me on about in my career, about what it is that I do every day, I don't need you to change what you're doing based on having talked to me ever. I just will be so satisfied if you see something a new way. If I can see that light bulb go on to where somebody goes, oh, I didn't think of it that way, or, oh, you know, that didn't occur to me. That right there, that makes my day. And so getting somebody to see something in a new way, and I'll tell you how this works. So in pricing, I do that all the time, just like that conversation that we just had about about presenting a compilation and review for a bonding agent as satisfying the agent to get your bond agent to get your bond back. Okay, so that's a new way to think about it that's going to resonate with the client. It was the same thing when I do it now with pricing. It was the same thing with social media. When I started down the path of social media, that's what I wrote the book about. I am so over social media, Jean. I don't ever want to talk about it ever again. But the similarity there, you're like, how do you go from social media to pricing or whatever it was before that? It's because I sat down with partners and I helped them to see that social media is not scary. I helped them see that this was 10 years ago. I started blogging about 10 or 11 years ago, and as soon as I started blogging, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is what our CPAs need to be doing. They have personalities. They have passion. They need to be putting it out there so people can find it and see how cool they are and how different they are. And what I had to show them is it's not as frightening as as you think. And so a breakthrough for me was one time I was facilitating a meeting for DFK, a managing partner meeting, and we were in that meeting and we were talking about technology and social media, and some of the partners were like, you know what? We have some people in our firm who sit around with their iPods and they've got earbuds in their ears and they're tuning everything out, and I don't like it. I don't like the fact that they're sitting there listening to their music while they're working. And I laughed. Well, I didn't laugh a lot out loud yet, but I did laugh a little bit later and everybody laughed out loud. I go, so how do you think that those kids that you're sitting there with their iPods got through school and got the straight A's that made them appeal to you while they were studying? What were they doing? You know, well, yeah, they were listening to their music. And I go, when you studied, when you were back in college, what did you do? Well, you know, did you have a stereo? Well, yeah, I had records and people were like, I had 8 tracks and I had cassettes. You know, you had all the different types of media, right? It went from radio to records to, you know, cassettes to CDs. And they were like, yeah, I have that. And I said, show of hands, how many of you have a stereo system in your office? Whole bunch of hands went up. And I go, then what is the problem with you getting mad about the kids with their iPods? They laughed. They're like, oh my God, it's the same thing. And then one guy goes, yeah, when we come in on Saturdays, people knock on my door and tell me to turn it down. Like, see, it's just like, think of something in a new way. Instead of getting mad about this technology, you know, realize that that's their focus. These kids are sitting in cubicles where I'd rather them listen to whoever it is that they're listening to on their iPod than listening to their cube mate across the way have an argument with his wife.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's just a whole new way of there are similarities and differences that you're pointing out. You know, the similarities are, you know, we all had our own way, you know, of studying, getting through school and learning things. We just, you know, we were all trying to get to the same point. We just did it in a different way.
Exactly. And that's how you focus. And there was that story you heard about probably of a bunch of executives in a boardroom with an intern in there, and they were all pondering, how do we get the answer to this particular question? And the intern, you know, nobody's paying attention. The intern pulls out his cell phone, texts somebody something. And then a few minutes later, he comes up with the answer and everybody's like, how did you do that? And he's like, I asked my buddy.
Right.
And they were like, oh.
You know? Or you Google. I mean, I have a friend that has said, you know, being able to, you know, smartphones and just being able to search for anything on your phone, it's reduced the number of arguments he has because you can find out the right answer right away. There's no back and forth about who's right.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
There are fewer bar fights, that's for sure.
Right. So let me ask you, so let me ask you the final two questions. So put yourself, you know, in the shoes of, you know, accounting marketers again. What is your best piece of advice for them, for accounting marketers?
Gosh, that's a toughie. I would say it's a toss-up between having patience and not giving up, which are like polar ends. It's find that balance. Mm-hmm. Between, but you know, it's pick your battles.
Right.
Don't give up on the really big, important stuff. Look at the big picture, maintain, but be willing to say, you know, this is my recommendation and not, but very big difference between those two words. This is my recommendation and it's ultimately your decision because you own the firm. Mm-hmm. Right. They will respect that. The very first consulting gig that I ever had was I worked with Anders in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. It was a local firm, and I went in. I was sitting there with the then managing partner and the marketing partner, and Bob asked me a question. Bob Minkler, and I looked at him and I go, "Do you want the politically correct answer, or do you want to know what I really think?" And he said, I want to know what you really think. And I'm thinking, I'm not going to get this job. But I told him what I really thought. And you know, I'm thinking, I know what he wants to hear. Don't do that. Even if you're in-house, if they don't want to hear what you really think, you're in the wrong place. Right. You can find, if you like accounting, which it's a wonderful, it's where I've chosen to make my career. I couldn't, there isn't a better group of people to work with. I've worked in law firms. I've worked in accounting firms. I've worked in public companies. There's no better group. If you like accounting, find a firm with a culture that works with you. Mm-hmm. So do not change who you are for the firm.
That's key. That's key. All right. So our closing question, what's your best piece of advice for managing partners?
That's a fun one. Okay. Mm-hmm. As it regards marketers?
Yes.
Okay. I would say hire a great marketer and listen to them and let them advise you. Do not start taking over and telling them how marketing should be, because that's not generally the managing partner skill set. Listen to them. Give it a couple years. It takes 2 to 3 years to start seeing, really to start seeing the fruits of those labors bubble up. Be patient. Listen. And you have to give them budget. Don't go out and hire somewhere between $50,000 and $150,000 a year person and not expect to give them a budget to work with. The budget isn't just their salary. They have to have something to work with that's different than what you already allocate to marketing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's great advice. Because the marketers think differently than partners do, but in many cases, it complements each other, and that's how you accomplish things within a firm, is working from everybody's strengths.
Yeah. Yep. And don't be scared, partners. Don't be scared.
Don't be scared of marketers or marketers?
Yeah. Don't be scared of marketers. They're outgoing. They're scary. They're loud. They say good morning. Don't be afraid of that.
That's right. Embrace it, right, Michelle? Get out of that box. Embrace it. Well, we've been talking today to Michelle Golden, who is the newest inductee into the Association for Accounting Marketing Hall of Fame. Michelle, I knew you would not disappoint. I appreciate your thoughts today, and thanks for your time.
Oh, my pleasure, Jean. Thank you so much for having me. It's always fun talking with you.